we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we're going to be looking at... What are we going to be looking at, Ben?
We're going to be looking at people who manage to blow things up with their brains.
Right. Okay. UFO, the psycho bombs. Got it. All right. I'm on the same page now. That is red dress, low cleavage, very, very mini skirt. I remember this episode well.
Naha.
A UFO ducks under the radar and lands on Earth. It takes mind control of a young woman in a red outfit with low cleavage and a very, very short mini skirt driving in a sports car. It also seems to take control of two other men, but then they're released. Later, the woman is stopped by the police, but she kills the policeman and escapes. Later, Straker encounters one of the three people on the side of the road, asking for a ride. Suspicious, Straker gives him the ride, but takes his picture. Before he gets out, the man rips Straker out of the car, knocking him unconscious. Later, Straker, unharmed, finds an ultimatum in his pocket. According to the note, if they do not disband Shadow, they will be destroyed. Three targets are identified. The first is a radar installation. The first possessed man walks right into the installation. He is arrested by the security, taken inside the building, cleared of having any weapons or threatening things of any kind, but he is confused. He has no idea why he's there. But suddenly the aliens take him over and, applying his hands to the electrical systems, blows up the entire station. Next, the second possessed man targets Skydiver 3. First, he goes to the security officer on board Skydiver, knocks him unconscious, later kills him, steals his fingerprints, goes to the station where the Skydiver is docked, tries to get on board, but is trapped in the voice print trap. That was something the aliens hadn't thought of. But he escapes through that through sheer brute strength and gets on top of the conning tower as Skydiver 3 sets out to sea. Just as it starts to submerge, he gets his hands on some high-voltage electricity and it's the end of Skydiver 3. They use a computer search to locate who the third person must be. Jackson has a crazy theory, once again, that perhaps somehow they have tapped into the cosmic forces of the universe and somehow created the potential energy for these people to become living bombs. Paul intercepts the young lady, the one I'd previously mentioned, who at the time was in a red dress with a nice cleavage and very, very short skirt, but now is in a completely different short skirt dress with low cleavage and a very, very short skirt. Foster is immediately entranced by her, and he applies the good old Foster charm, and bloody hell, it worked. Well, anyway, or is she working on him? It's not clear in this episode. So Foster takes her back to Shadow headquarters, which I don't know why, and she escapes. As she's just about to blow up the station, Straker's forces blow up the UFO, and she dies a horrible death. The end of the episode. So what do you think of
this? Very good, very good. That was so well done.
I was slightly winging that one just a bit, but I think I hit all the important parts, didn't I?
Most definitely, yeah.
What did you think of this episode?
Oh, I have no idea what to think of this episode. I don't know. Maybe in the course of our conversation, I might be able to actually come to a conclusion as to whether I liked it or not.
I thought it was, well, for crying out, I don't, no.
All right, let
this
me start
plot this doesn't make any sense to
no,
me at all.
No, this thing has just got loose threads, plot holes that you can literally drive a semi through. I mean, this thing is just, it's a mess.
It's kind of a cool idea. That they can take control of people.
You know, and we're back to the whole idea of the aliens being able to take control of people. I would say that if this were my very first UFO episode, I would have loved it. But the fact that this is not, that I've seen a whole slew of UFO episodes prior to this one, it seriously alters my perception of a countless number of story points in here.
Yeah, I guess let's start with what I would consider to be the biggest plot flaw in the whole thing. Why did they issue an ultimatum?
That's the big one. What was the whole point?
Well, why didn't they just...
Why don't just
sneak somebody into Shadow Headquarters somehow?
Well, okay.
And this get some high energy.
Well, this goes back to what we had been kind of commenting on ever since Jackson, and I want to get back to that. Ever since Jackson finally gave the big reveal, you know, I think these really are not aliens. You know,
that's right, Stampy.
I think. I think they're really humans. Yeah. So when it was discovered that maybe these really are just humans that are being, I mean, they're not mentally hijacked by aliens like we've seen in this one, but they are aliens, for lack of a better word, at this point.
Yeah, I mean, we've got earlier episodes where we work on the assumption that these people who are the quote unquote aliens are actually humans who've had their brains or their mind patterns or whatever you want to say completely replaced.
Right.
We've also seen they apparently can do that with a cat.
Yeah.
But then in that same episode, instead of doing that to Regan, hey, I remembered his name.
Very good.
I'm impressed. They just sort of exert the fluence over him.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the man who came back, and his name I can't remember.
I just saw his name the other day. I can't remember it now.
But same thing. He was kind of under the fluence, but not like taken over. That these people, this is a completely different kind of taken over. They kind of go into zombie mode when they're over. And I kind of get the impression if they just parked that UFO outside Shadow Headquarters and caught the first person going to work at Shadow and zapped him up, they could have just driven right in, found some high voltage, and kaboomo.
Well, so this, now, again, this really brings up the whole issue of what is the agenda. At first, we thought it was all about harvesting humans. Well, find out that's not really the case. Even though all the physical evidence in the earliest episode suggested that it was. Jackson says, well, no, not really. So if that's not their end game, then what is? And why try to have this big surrender from Shadow? It's almost like they're trying to, there's an opportunity. I wouldn't call it negotiation.
Yeah. It's like we're trying to come to a peaceful conclusion, and the peaceful conclusion is you giving up your defenses.
I know, but for what purpose? I mean, what are they going to get? Is this so they can just then start taking people left and right? And that brings up the other enormous plot hole, and that is, well, if they can just start controlling people like that, why not just have everybody go to all the UFO ships like sheep,
mm-hmm.
instead of having to go hunting for them?
Yeah. It did have a little, it did seem once again, it was an excuse to show the cool idea of some of the powers of the aliens.
But it didn't really make
sense in the context of a story.
No, and it doesn't make any sense in the context of the overall series, given everything that we've seen so far. Yeah, we've had that conversation already. There was no such thing really as story arcs like we have in so many shows today. But there's like a total lack of continuity going on here now.
We could almost call it a discontinuity arc.
Yeah, I was about to call it that. I mean, it's a huge discontinuity in terms of the overall behavior and attitude of the UFO aliens. I mean, all this does, it just adds more mystery to who the heck they really are and what is it that they really want. And I don't mind their, you know, having layer upon layer of mystery being added to it, but this isn't that. What we're getting is layer and layer of more confusing facts.
Yeah, it still comes back to why the live and let live attitude. He says, oh, well, if you shut down Shadow, fine. Otherwise, we're going to blow it up. Like, why not just blow it up? I just totally do not get that
they offered them that out by saying, if you do all this, we'll not blow you up. So clearly, this is a strong arm negotiation, but it's a negotiation nonetheless.
Would they have gotten more from Shadow closing its defenses down than if they just blew up Shadow headquarters? Maybe that's it. Maybe they would have gotten the moon bases dismantled and the interceptors, but if they just blew up Shadow headquarters, they'd still have to deal with the Shadow personnel continuing to try to regroup and reform. I mean, is that remotely plausible?
No.
Nah, well.
No, not really.
I'm stretching. I'm trying to find something that's
I know. I couldn't find any details, any hidden facts that might suggest why they're behaving the way they are. I couldn't find anything to suggest why they would take this new approach.
Yeah. And to give them warnings. Oh, we'll blow up a radar installation. Okay, we'll blow up Skydiver 3. Why Skydiver 3 specifically? Why not blow up Skydiver?
Well, probably because Skydiver 3, being that it was finishing construction, they had easy access to it.
That means pretty good intel.
That's the next thing. Where are they getting all this information? They've got some really great intel somewhere. I would like to know, where are they getting all these facts to allow them? I mean, first there was that base.
Mm-hmm.
That
the radar installation.
The radar installation that Silver, I mean, David Collings, yeah. I mean, whatever the heck his name is. Modron.
Modron, yeah.
Yeah, or Paul from Robots of Death. He really gets around, doesn't he?
Is it Paul?
Paul from Robots of Death, yes.
Wasn't it Pool? It was Pool.
Or Pool. Well, that was it. Yeah, Pool. But okay.
I was going to say, they didn't have ordinary names in that, did they?
Well, yeah, I'm just reading the spelling.
Oh.
And is it, okay, maybe in some parts of the UK, they pronounce it Paul. I don't know.
They call it Pool. It's in Ireland, they'd call it that. It's Pool.
Yeah. All right. So, but in any case.
It's not part of England. I just don't write. I know. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, the fact that they knew about that, I mean, we didn't know about that. We were never introduced to that. Knowing about getting into Shadow. I mean, I can sort of understand why maybe they know about Straker. I mean, because, you know, several times definitely once, they've had an attempt to try to kill him. And then there was another opportunity where it looked like, okay, here's enough. You know, we weren't originally planning to do it, but hey, the opportunity landed in our laps. Let's kill Straker. So,
kill Straker, yes.
Oh, yes,
and here's their chance. They had Straker. They could have killed him right then and there.
They could have.
But instead, they just knock him unconscious and give him an ultimatum.
Well, it was to plant that letter. It was all to plant that letter, because next time we see him, he's coming into his office and he's wagging this paper around and he hands it off to Paul, and Paul looks at him and then he reads it out loud.
I know. It's as if the aliens do everything alien, because I'm thinking writing the letter and putting it in the mail and addressing it to the studio might get it to Straker too, without risking exposure, getting your picture taken. And,
I don't know. I'm sure they must have. Well, clearly they have some kind of transmission system. I'm sure they could have sent a signal.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it makes no sense.
No.
A lot of this episode. I mean, and that's the thing that just bugged me to no end.
I mean, I liked Silver going there and cutting through the fence with his bare hand. And then later seeing that he had basically ripped his hand apart doing that under the alien spell. So
yeah, that's, you know, and when Jackson finally says, you know, I have a theory. And he starts saying, you know, that
Kronstein.
I think they could, you know, channel the entire forces of the universe, you know, and become like a psycho bomb.
It's a crazy theory. Yeah.
It's a strange theory. Let's hear it. Well, as I heard that, I kept thinking, you know, that sounds like magic.
I guess,
the only reason I say this is because I happened to stumble across an old NBC broadcast of Doctor Strange from years ago when I was in high school. I know that dreadful thing.
Sorry to hear that.
I know, but there, but there is a line in there where Linmer, who's talking to Stephen Strange, says, you know, you challenge or channel the, you know, the natural forces of the universe through you to control you and blah, blah, blah. And then I watched this and I thought, well, that's the same bloody thing. Really? I mean, they've got all the power of the universe at their command. It allows them to have super strength. I would imagine, although I would love to have seen it put to the test, I would like to have actually seen a guard shoot one of them. Mm-hmm. I figure if you put enough bullets in them, I mean, eventually, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're still human.
Yeah, the body's going to fail. But, you know, you take one step closer, I'm going to use this gun. It's like, well, don't talk, use it. Bad behavior. So you've got them with the super strength, and then when they grab electrical leads and make some kind of contact, massive explosions. It's like, well, it really kind of sounds like some sort of, you know, magic, so to speak.
I'd have been much happier if they had actually done something to their bodies physically that allowed them to be explosives. You know,
to be honest, I would have liked that better. Instead of this idea of just being able to channel all the energies of the universe, you know, and becoming like some gigantic cosmic magnet. I think that's something like what Jackson says. He says, you know, it's becoming like a magnet of all the power of the universe.
So after we have Silver, I thought it was, the other thing I thought was kind of interesting was that they spent not a huge amount of time, but they did spend a little time showing the domestic life of David Collins' character and the girl's character. They didn't really show much of Jeff Randall's.
No.
So that's Jeff Randall from Randall and Hopkirk Deceased. Mike Pratt, I believe is his name. He was the third.
Right.
He was the third individual in the list. He was just on the job doing construction one day and then walked off. But like they kept showing David Collins go back to bed in his little house in the country with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did think it was interesting that, and I thought this was strictly an American thing.
Oh, the twin beds?
The twin beds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised by that too.
Unless it was because this was shot for American so it could be sold to the Americans.
It's
which, considering possible? The horn dog that Paul Foster is.
No, I know.
Hey, that girl's a dangerous. Look at that skirt.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you some questions. Okay, ask me some questions.
After this lip lock.
Oh, no. He starts off with, would you like to go for a walk? Okay.
Would you like to have some lunch?
Yeah, then later on, what was the questions? Would you like lunch? Okay.
Okay.
<It's> like, I mean, Paul Foster was in full-on Foster mode.
He really was.
He really was. But the thing is that got me is, was he or was she doing that to him?
You know, that's a great question. I wasn't quite sure what was going on. And to be honest, one of the moments...
The aliens obviously knew what Foster was doing because they kept
absolutely.
She kept shifting into that sort of trance mode there when he wasn't looking and they were kissing. But I couldn't tell if that was just the aliens were keeping an eye on what was going on or the aliens were actively encouraging this behavior.
Well, to be honest, I don't think... We've never seen... If they were actually encouraging the behavior... On her part.
Not that Foster takes much encouraging in that department.
No, but what that means is that that would be the only time we've actually seen them, at least in this particular episode, exercise with any kind of subtlety.
True.
Because with the previous two,
what,
there was nothing
the subtle
about their behavior.
Wasn't subtle enough for you?
No, yeah. No, with the previous two, there was absolutely nothing subtle regarding their behavior whenever they were feeling the influence of the alien tech. I mean, they were just, as you said, you know, they behave like zombies almost. I mean, totally, total mind control. In fact, you know, and if you look at past episodes, when the mind control seemed very, very apparent, I mean, that you could clearly tell they were, you know, consciously not there anymore. And we saw that repeatedly throughout this episode. But in this particular case, when it looked like she was under the influence, you know, and then you see Foster grab her, he takes her into his arms and he kisses her. And the next scene, you know, you cut to a commercial break. Next scene, they're running around and she's laughing. And the first thought that I had was, ooh, Paul has got more power in that kiss Foster mode is stronger than UFO mode.
Yeah, that was stretching my credibility, I have to say.
Among other things in this episode.
The foster power. However, now, and this is the thing. All of that was just like, up till that point, I felt as if the aliens just were paying attention. And when Foster wasn't looking, they would be like taking over for a second, kind of like putting up the periscope, then kind of looking around and going, okay, I'm with the Shadow Colonel Foster here. He seems to be, is that a shadow rocket in your pocket there? Okay, fine. Let's let this carry its course. And then they would cut off to keep Foster, you know, with the girl. But then when he takes her to Shadow headquarters, Colonel Lake says, Paul's bringing her to Shadow headquarters. And
he's doing what?
What? Oh, never mind. It doesn't matter. That dismissive line says there's no reason he should ever do this, yet for some reason he has, and so therefore I imply he was taken over. That this was her exerting something to get him to take her to Shadow headquarters, which is where she wanted to be, to blow things up.
Yeah, it is sort of suggested, and previous episodes do also suggest that kind of relay behavior control is possible, but at least in the past, it felt a little clearer. Here, it was somewhat ambiguous. I really couldn't quite make that out to be
certain. She may have been leading him around in some other way that was not necessarily psychic, let's say. I mean, she was leading Foster around by his Foster Jr., I really like to see a movie studio, Paul. It's like, okay. I don't know. I really don't know.
I'm not certain, to be honest. I really couldn't be sure.
So when Straker dismisses it, all right, never mind why he's done it. Ignore it. Is that supposed to be giving the audience credit that you can figure out that Foster was under the influence of the girl who caused him to bring her to the studio? Or was that just, you know, disposing of another bad plot element that we needed to have, which was that somehow she needed to get to Shadow headquarters?
To be honest, I think it's the latter. I mean, I really think they were just trying to quickly find a way to get her in there.
That makes me sad.
And it does, but there's so many other things about this episode that make me sad. Oh, there's so many things that are wrong with it.
But there is one thing. There's three things that's right with this episode. Three things. It's all three dresses that woman was wearing.
Ah.
There was absolutely no imagination in them whatsoever.
Oh, no.
They're exact same dress in three different materials.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like, do people dress? Oh, wait, I dress in the same style pants and shirt every day. So, okay, maybe that's actually, that's an unfair.
I mean,
1984.
Well, the show was made in the 60s. That kind of style. I mean, Sylvia, I'm sure she, you know, as we've said before, she was taking, you know, what was very contemporary fashion at that time and extrapolating.
Maybe shorter.
Well, in 20 years' time, it'll be shorter, but it'll all be the same cut.
You know, I saw some pictures online somewhere, or in a magazine, or online from a magazine or something. And I don't think they were in the story, because I think I would have noticed it. But in that montage where Paul is swinging her around and they're having all the fun in the park and all that stuff, there are some pictures there that show what the dangers of having a skirt that short are. And I imagine...
believe me, there was little left to the imagination
by the time
the episode was finished.
I think they were a little more discreet in what finally hit the air, so they could
get it on the air.
Yeah. I've been distracted by the skirt again. That's multiple times in this episode, which is true with the psycho bombs too. It's like, well, this plot hole doesn't, well, that doesn't make, ooh, skirt. Kind of thing.
Okay, so there's Eugene's shiny object.
Shiny. It was intentional.
Uh-huh.
It seriously was intentional. I mean, ignoring Sylvia Anderson and her dress sense, because we know that she was doing the fashion designing, and she, like, the moon base uniforms that they could tear off their legs so that they would become a mini skirt, which was so obvious in the, probably in the pilot episode or first episode. You know, when you're going into the recreation dome on Moonbase, and
when you're going off duty,
yeah, you just rip off parts of your clothes so that you can be in a
and
lot
now
more
you're in relaxed outfit
mode.
Yeah.
So I mean, that was contrived to show off the fashion. I didn't feel that these were contrived to show off the fashion, but let's face it, the very first shot of this woman driving her Porsche 914 down the road is a shot down her cleavage.
True.
It's not even subtle. I mean, I had not remembered that from the episode, but while I was watching it to review for the podcast, the first shot of her, and it's like through the windshield, down the cleavage, and I'm like, I can't even see her face. They've utterly, utterly objectified this woman, which I feel guilty for sort of...
For falling for it?
Yeah. It's like, she got paid. It's not the clothes, right? They weren't objectifying the clothes in this one. They were
objectifying her.
And she was across the
but
board.
But she's a very pretty lady. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to give you, I'll give you that. She's a very good looking woman.
So I can see why, you know, Paul would put the hard word on her.
And that might have been why they were objectifying her to... perhaps, you know, and I'm stretching here, you know, because I personally, I don't believe this, but maybe somebody thought by objectifying her in the television show, maybe we can kind of rationalize it, validate what we're doing here by having Paul just completely choke on his, you know, and trip over his tongue. As
or something, yeah.
Yeah, or something, yeah. Or Foster Jr.
Foster Jr. there. yeah, it... In a way, maybe. I mean, from the very first get-go when we see her, I suppose I should have been thinking, Foster is going to try to tap that. That could be exactly what we should have been thinking.
It was telegraphed.
Yeah. It's like, they're going to hold those two apart until we reach a certain part of the episode, and then Foster is...
Oh, he's all over that.
He's all over that.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, this is the man who makes sure they retcon girls and then goes back for them. And uses his advanced knowledge of things they've forgotten to use against them.
Mm-hmm.
He is a cad.
The man's an animal.
I shall miss Paul Foster when he's gone.
Well, let's talk about somebody who was not gone. Jackson.
Yes. He was not gone.
He was not gone. We thought he was gone. We thought he was a goner in one episode.
That's right. We thought that they whacked him or killed him or something in that episode, but they apparently just knocked him unconscious. That was who came back, wasn't it?
The man who came back.
Yeah.
And, we were all kind of led to believe the way that scene was being played out because, was that Regan?
No.
No, that was the other guy.
That was the other guy.
Every time he came into contact with somebody, he killed them.
Except for Jackson, yeah.
Except for, you know, but the way... Jackson had his meeting with him in that episode or the way he approached Jackson. I mean, it really felt very telegraphed that he was a goner. And then we had one episode, maybe two, where there was no Jackson at all. And then we get Jackson back doing his Peter Lorre or whatever the heck little accent he has.
Completely natural.
Yeah, it is his. That is the way he speaks, and that's why I always call him Dr. Creepy. But in a really weird way, I kind of like the guy.
He is an odd looking actor.
He is
definitely with that Slavic accent of his, and the look that he has. He really is fit for being in a castle, in a cape. kind of. You know what I mean?
Yes, but absolutely.
And I've never seen him play anything like that. He usually plays Soviet spies.
Right.
And yeah. And usually, I'd say in most instances I've ever seen him, he always plays brilliant ones.
Oh, yeah.
He kind of has that sort of condescending Russian
he manages to carry with him this air of intellect in the roles that he plays. But I think you're right. I think there was a huge missed opportunity. If Hammer horror films had gotten a hold of him back in the 50s, I mean he would have had a huge career alongside Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, he was certainly a he was in From Russia with Love, and that might be his biggest, most famous movie that he's ever been in.
Right.
And he played that part pretty well, although he did die sooner in that episode than I'd hoped for. But I liked him as a villain better than Rosa Klebb. Lottie Lenya. There we go.
Yeah.
All right.
No, I mean, because he's a fun actor to watch. I do enjoy watching him, and I've mocked him horribly. I've said a lot of disparaging things about him, past,
in a funny accent, in a condescendingly funny accent.
Oh, he's very patronizing in the way he talks, and yeah, that accent, which I could not imitate. I mean, I do the Peter Lorre bit because it's the closest thing I can come to. But I cannot imitate the way he talks. I mean, but there's something rather hypnotic about it, especially when he says, "I think I have a theory. It's a strange theory.
But I'll tell you if you
but
want
I'll tell
to
you
hear
anyway
it.
If you want to hear it."
Yeah.
It's like, I want to lock up my children before I listen to anything he has to say. he is kind of creepy, but in a really weird way, I like him. But it was surprising to see him. I wasn't expecting that.
Well, at least we got... at least we get to see him before, because we're winding out episodes now in the series, so we want the whole gang together. I want to see
Alec.
There we go, Freeman back. I know it's not going to happen, but
no.
I really, you know,
I want to see him all over Colonel Lake one more time.
No, Foster's been there already, so it's too late.
Oh, that wouldn't stop Freeman.
That's what I want to see. I want to see Freeman and Foster out on the pull.
I'm sure there's an outtake somewhere.
I and my old friend here.
Ew.
He may cut his hair like a 20-year-old, but he's really 60. Well, there you go.
Okay, sure.
Colonel Lake was in this episode, too.
Yes, she was.
That's about all I can say for her.
Yeah, she really didn't have... She had very, very little. I mean, we know that her and Paul went out looking for Miss Skirt at one time. That's about it. I mean, she tries to call Paul. Of course, by then, it's already too late. He's gone traipsing off with her.
Yeah.
Really, that's about it. I mean, she doesn't have much to do in this one.
And she gets to play rough in room 22 there for a while, but even that's just kind of pointless.
Just for show. I mean, it served no purpose to the story.
Yeah.
So, her presence was... It's like, we're paying her. We might as well write her a few lines.
I don't know that I have anything else here. I think we've gone over the aliens' wacky plan again. That's the sad thing, is that week after week now we're really getting into this sort of the aliens have a wacky plan.
Yeah, it's the wacky plan of the week episode now.
So now,
and it seems like it's getting just a little bit wackier almost.
It's, you know what it is? It's not wacky. This is so hard for writers.
Illogical, maybe.
It's alien.
Well, yeah.
It's alien logic.
But it's
it's so alien.
I know, but that's giving them credit, really.
This is a very hard thing for writers to do, to write truly alien aliens, because basically they just put aliens in as a substitute for some social or political type that they
that
don't want to use in the modern time.
Hats
off for truly alien thinking aliens.
I know, but I think you're giving them a little bit too much credit, because when you're writing, even if you're writing a science fiction story where your aliens are serving as some sort of a metaphor for a relatable human threat, it has to be, as I just said, it has to be something that we can relate to. Otherwise, the sense of conflict, the sense of dramatic tension that you're trying to write in the story, really, that kind of just falls flat. Because your audience will then end up spending more time trying to think, now, wait a minute, why? They're going to be questioning, you know, why the heck are you doing that? I mean, like we've been doing, why, what is their motive? I mean, you can just start, you become more analytical instead of allowing yourself to get drawn into the episode and whatever dramatic tension they're trying to create. I mean, I applaud the idea of them trying to create something that's alien, but I don't think it's working here.
So let me ask you this question, so that just to try to have something fun to talk about. Is logic a universal construct, or is it a societal construct, or not even societal is necessarily a word, it's a construct manifest of our humanity? In other words, if you were to take logical constructs or logical fallacies, such as A is of type B, B is of type C, therefore A is of type C, right?
You're applying a transitive theory,
right?
If you're dealing with pure facts,
we always think we'll be able to communicate in these universal truths that we hold true. But are they actually universal truths, or are they universal truths to the way we think? And obviously, I think personally that our universal truths are, in fact, genuinely 2 + 2 = 2 is a universal truth. But maybe they're not. And if that's the case, then look out, universe, because we are taking over. Because you guys are a bunch of illogical idiots, just like the aliens in UFO, right? I mean, if that's they got, we're taking them down.
Well, I would agree with that. I could argue it either way. On the surface, my first thought was, well, a universal truth is a universal truth, you know, and logic, but
we're defining it as universal. I know. So
that's true. We are. So clearly we're starting off with a very subjective point of view, but if use the mathematics as you just described. I mean, if mathematics being the constant that it is, and if logic, if you're going to apply any kind of logical deduction and logical truth based on the same kind of ideas as mathematics, then yeah, it would be universal. At least I would assume it is. But then again, I remember watching, reading Carl Sagan's Contact. And there's some reference about how these aliens, well, you know, they think in this different way. They think in multiple dimensions and this other thing. So therefore, their conclusion is this. And I thought, well, oh, gee, you know, okay, yeah. My conscious, you know, my thinking has just been expanded a little bit. But
that's right.
We would
argue that a triangle always has 180 degrees. And it doesn't matter how you measure them.
It always comes to 180.
Well, you know, whether it's degrees or radians or whatever, right, whatever it happens to be. I mean, it's the relative ratios have to work out the way. But if you had a being that thought in four dimensions, then perhaps triangles are not the way that they think.
And perhaps all the other areas of the way they think are similarly affected. Now, I don't have a problem with that, but if you're going to be telling a story where your primary antagonists are like this, you need to, at some point, give the viewer some kind of something for them to relate to, something so that, and it could be really challenging at this point for the viewer and the writer. You give them a little bit of information so that it becomes a guessing game. The viewer then gets the opportunity to kind of, they can deduce, well, maybe the aliens are going to use this particular tactic, or maybe they'll go with this other way. You know, and then maybe when the final plan is revealed, whether it succeeds or fails, at least the viewer at that point can then say, oh, okay, all right, I can see how they managed to pull this one over my eyes, but I can see why maybe they would come to that kind of conclusion if we are going with that kind of alien thinking. We're not given any of that. Instead, we're giving a lot of what seems like very disjointed and illogical actions.
Fascinating.
Yeah, that don't seem to have any sense of continuity to them.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where now I have to keep asking myself, well, what the hell is it that the aliens want? Now, again, maybe this was something that Jerry had sort of in mind and was asking his writers to kind of go with, because maybe he thought that he was going to get a second season. You know, by this point, I'm sure he realized, well, that wasn't ever going to happen. Well, the series is sunk as it is. But maybe in the beginning he had this thought that, we'll mess with the viewer's mind, you know, we'll dangle these really weird clues in front of them and they're not going to know what the heck to make of them. And then maybe in the first couple episodes of the next season, we'll finally give them this one, that last piece of the puzzle, and they can, all of a sudden, everything will start to make sense. I don't know. Maybe I'm giving Jerry too much credit by saying that. But I can't.
Yeah, you are.
I think you're right. I think I am. You know, but I can't. Oh, I can't really emotionally feel any kind of threat from the aliens, because their actions just don't make one shred of sense.
Not really, no.
I mean, this is how I have my write-up. My last paragraph, I'm going to read it exactly as it is written.
Complete with punctuation errors. I don't know.
What punctuation errors?
I don't know. I haven't seen it. I'm just a completist.
Mm-hmm. Logically, this episode is a mess. There are too many unanswered questions, and yet, and then here's the positive stuff. The dramatic tension was incredible. I knew that Skydiver 3 was doomed, and yet I held my breath throughout the entire buildup of that fateful moment, which is true. But yet again, the details of this episode are totally inconsistent. The faults of the story were enough to put it right at my quote-unquote tipping point. Not quite enough to make me dislike the story, but so incredibly high that it took away from what I thought would have been a terrifically dramatic and suspenseful episode. So from, like I said earlier, if this had been my very first UFO episode, I would have loved it, because the dramatic tension would have been so incredibly high. But it wasn't. I've got this entire history of UFO that we've already watched. So I have all this knowledge based on past behavior that we've seen the aliens have with all these stories, and nothing adds up. So I find myself, while the dramatic tension regarding, you know, will Skydiver 3 get away? I really don't think so. Story-wise, they really have to blow up, but oh my God, I was really caught up in that moment. But at the same time, I kept asking myself all sorts of really, really stupid questions, like, why not dive as soon as you possibly can and just really punch it?
Yeah, I mean, I was holding my breath when he was up on the conning tower, too, at that moment, but it wasn't so much from tension. It was just like, I wonder if I can hold my breath as long as he can when they dive the submarine.
You know, actually, I did the same thing. I caught myself doing the same thing. So, interesting. But at the same time, like I said, there was some really good dramatic tension in there, but I spent more time puzzling over, why is this happening? Why are the aliens doing this? If they have this power, why not do this instead? Why are we negotiating? What is the end game? None of this makes sense. Clearly they can communicate.
Yeah. Doesn't make sense. No, well, I think it's, I think it. We just put that episode to rest. I think we'll just go on to the next one. I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but when we come back for UFO, we'll be talking about the next wacky plot by the aliens.
Yay!
And Ben, thank you for joining me tonight.
My
for
pleasure.
Our version of One Gay, One Straight Geek Talk. And we'll let the audience figure out which one's which. And
I think that's a no-brainer, really.
Did I mention that skirt? Wow. No.
yeah, the shiny object, Eugene.
And we hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolfe.